Because today we're going to start, as we said, the Shema. In Parshas Ve'eschanan, we did the Aseres HaDibris for a few weeks. They have fascinating ideas in the Aseres HaDibris and the repetition. And now we're moving on to the Shema, which is a few psukim later. It's a bit, it's Moshe Rabbeinu's speech. And what's interesting is that I always wonder, when you think about Shema, so it has the pasuk of Shema and the Ahavta, the first paragraph. Of all of the verses in the Torah, this is the most famous one. There's no question this is the one that's the most known by the widest, if you want to say, type of Jew, knows the word, especially the words Shema Yisrael. And it's interesting why, of all the words in the Torah, are these the words that everybody knows and that everybody says? And let's hope we'll explore a little bit as we learn to understand the depth. What is so special about these words? Why is it that these are the words that are really, really so well known? So before we go inside into the psukim, because I would like to just actually read them inside and see what Rashi says, I just want to give a little bit of an introduction of based on one story. Now, there are many stories. With Shema Yisrael, you can go through hundreds and hundreds of stories. But I just want to read you. I didn't make you a copy of this. This is what I'm going to read you is from I don't know if you call it even a talk. It was from the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe at a Purim Tish that he had, a Purim Suda, and he shared, and putting in context, this was 1940, and he had just escaped from Europe himself. He had just been in Europe, so he had escaped from the Nazis, and now he was in New York. So although he was safe, he knew what was going on. He had, as I say, just personally experienced it, as well as not only did he experience, because he was in Warsaw, but he also experienced the communists. That's where he was imprisoned. And so he had gone from Russia to Warsaw, in between he was in Riga, and then now he's in New York. So he's coming with a tremendous amount of pain, and he expresses that, worry and concern for the Jews who are in that part of the world. And generally, he writes emotionally, and he was a very emotional, expressive kind of person. I'm just going to read you some of what he said. So first he starts, it was actually, as I said, a Purim Suda, which is interesting. So he said, I'll just read you one paragraph how he describes what he's like. He says, "However, I am weighted down by what I have undergone, rather by what I am undergoing. Because even after arriving in this land, which is currently known as the land of repose," so it was a haven, as we know, to be in America, "the experiences of a few weeks ago are still weighing me down, now as then, when I lived among our crushed and despairing brethren." And he says, and he describes, "My aching heart bleeds over the destruction of Yiddishkeit, the destruction of religious life," which is obviously in Russia under the communists, "the harsh and bitter life of the God-fearing Jews in certain countries, and the life-threatening danger to the millions of Jews who live there." So both the European Jews as well as the Russian Jews, who also were in danger of the Nazis, as we know. The only difference was that some of the Russian Jews were and did, as we know, run either to Siberia or to the countries deeper in, like Kazakhstan. Many were saved in Samarkand and in Tashkent, in Uzbekistan. They ran all the way to those countries, and they did find haven there because the Nazis didn't get there, right? It was a lot of poverty and a lot of hunger, but nevertheless, they managed, some of them, to survive. However, we do know, and we know now more than ever, it was quite close, that many of the Russian Jews were killed, and they were just shot, whether it be in Lithuania, whether it be in the Ukraine, Babi Yar, and all the different cities, as we know, the ones that the Nazis managed to get to, they were killed just outright. And in a way, it's even harder. There's no records of a lot of them, whereas in the concentration camps, we do have some records. Whereas there's no records, so there are many, as we know, just mass graves of Jews in those areas. However, still, some did manage to escape and run further east. And yet, as the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe says, they had both danger physically and spiritually. And then, of course, the European Jews who were just, he saw what was going on. Anyways, I'm not going to read you the whole thing. I want to go to one part then. He describes what was happening and his experience. And he's going back a few months. So it's Purim when he's talking. but he's reflecting back a few months before, which was actually the time just of the Yomim Tovim, of Tishrei time, which is just a few months before when he was in Warsaw. And he describes this. This is the part that I want to show you, something very, so incredible. He says, the Baal Shem Tov teaches that whatever a Jew hears or sees is a directive for his service of Hashem. This means not only whatever happens with a person is specifically arranged by divine providence. Beyond that, it means that from every incident, and even from everything or word that a Jew hears or sees, he should derive a lesson in the realm of Torah or in his Avodah. So we know that there's a famous thing that's taught. Obviously, what we experience, we learn from, but it's not just what we experience, it's what we hear, even secondhand, what somebody else experienced. Or if we hear or see something, we're meant to somehow derive some type of a lesson in our service of Hashem. So he says, in every single event, whether good or, God forbid, bad, there must certainly be at least something that can be useful in furthering his service of his Creator. As is widely known, there is no good without evil and no evil without good. That's in this world at the moment, that's the way it is, except for obviously pure good, which is Torah, but otherwise in this world, everything is gray, as we say, right? It's all mixed. So he says, in everything there is a mixture of evil, and in every evil there's a mixture of good. The 12th of Tishrei during the war is noted in my memory as one of the most difficult days that I ever experienced. And just want to put it in context. He's going to describe what happened on that day, but the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe himself experienced tremendous suffering at the hands of the Bolsheviks. He was actually sentenced to death. He was interrogated, he was taken to prison, he was treated, he was actually abused, he was thrown down steps. He describes it very, very, he broke things, it was terrible. So for him to say this is the worst of what he experienced, you understand it must have been really bad, like really, really. So just on those layers. So he says like this, on that day at noon, we all left our home to seek shelter in a deep cellar. At 4 o'clock, after Mincha, the cellar was shaken up by an air raid attack on the adjoining streets. Fires broke out immediately, and as multi-story buildings collapsed, they buried their inhabitants in the debris. Good morning, Riva. I'm just reading a recollection of the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, how he was when he was in Warsaw. It was 1939, the beginning of the war, and the Germans were obviously bombing. Okay, so he sees like this. In the face of the immediate danger of being, God forbid, unable to save ourselves, we ran out of the cellar to seek shelter in the gateway of one of the big buildings. Anyways, he describes, I mean, it's a bit gory. Okay, so the screams of alarmed townsfolk, especially children, women, and old folk, is indescribable. As the bombardment grew more intense from 1 minute to the next, more and more streets of houses went up in flames. Okay, I won't describe the flames, but then he says, for a few hours, we and several other people ran, afraid and exhausted, from one shelter to another. In one of those havens, a few hundred people of various types had assembled. Jews with long coats and beards and payas, and women wearing wigs, clean-shaven Jews, and women who spoke only Polish, all stood there, as he says, totally, yeah, obviously devastated, like beyond afraid. Our group, he says, myself and my family and a few dozen students of the Tamchei Tmimim, the yeshiva that was associated with the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, said Tehillim. Suddenly there was a fearsome blast. A bomb exploded near our group. A river of fire immediately gushed forth. Every one of us saw death before his eyes. And at that very moment, everyone cried out in one voice, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elikeinu Hashem Echad. Everyone was certain that this was the last minute of his life. Such a Shema Yisrael cried out from the depths of the hearts of such varied people with such a wide range of philosophies, I have never heard. And I ask Hashem that this recollection should be preserved in my memory forever. During those wartime days, not only did everyone see the workings of divine providence and Elikus at every step, but in addition one could see how the sound heart of a Jew is saturated with genuine, simple faith. Witnessing so manifestly how powerfully and how profoundly a belief in Hashem is rooted in the heart of a Jew. That is the good that I learned from the midst of the evil. That's how, because he started off that every evil has good, every every good has evil. This is the good in the evil. The evil was beyond what was going on, as we know. And he says, the artless faith that surfaced in that universal outcry of Shema Yisrael opened up for me new wellsprings of love and reverence for the Jewish sons and daughters, wherever they may be. My deep conviction, based on factual proofs, is that the Torah and mitzvah's heart of our fellow Jew is alive. It is only that in some places they have grown faint, and the task of rousing them is in the hands of inspiring speakers, educators, and mentors. And so it's obviously it's quite a detailed and very emotional. He puts us back to where he was. But this is not an unusual story. We read these stories all the time. We read these stories throughout history. You know, whenever we were, I mean, children, and we would read the stories of the Spanish Inquisition. And like in those days when I was a child, I think about it now, it was so unreal. It was so like historical. These things happened thousands of years ago, whatever. Not thousands, but almost, feels like. And then you learned about the Cossacks and Khmelnytsky, and you learned about the pogroms, and we learned, and you know, we go through history with all, and even the Hanukkah story, and even the Purim story, and you know, but these are all historical stories. And of course, the Holocaust was much closer to our hearts and much closer to our time, and we knew people, so it was much more real. And the Holocaust had its own variation on it, as we know, but we did hear of stories of people screaming out Shema Yisrael as they were dying, and even in the cattle cars and the animamins that they sang, of course, all kinds. And but it was still past tense for most of us. At least it was one generation before. Unfortunately, we're living through such times now. We would never imagine that it would happen again, but it is happening again. I think for us, I mean, I would have said a few months ago, for us in Sydney, it's still one step removed. It's not even one step removed anymore. We're just living through that now, day by day, minute by minute. And what we see, we have, as he'd started, such, in a way, it's such a contrast, I think, that we're living in, because we see such evil and such a distorted, such a convoluted, such a disbelieving kind of evil, such a, like, something that you can't even rationalize, we can't grasp it because it's so beyond. And then you see such good, and that's what's incredible. So much good in ourselves, in the Jewish people, in the people in Israel, the strength. I mean, of course, it's, as we said, they're tired. It's enough. They are tired, and it really is enough. But nevertheless, the strength that they have is unbelievable. And the Jewish people all over the world, how people are more and more and more identifying, realizing that their Jewishness is not something they can just, you know, put in the back burner. It's there, whether they like it or not, it's there. And it's coming up more and more. It doesn't matter what they practice, but the identity that they're Jewish, it's first and foremost, I'm a Jew. That's it. There's nothing, you know, that's a fact. So it's quite incredible. That's unfortunately what comes out in difficult times. But we see, this is what we call, many times we label it the Shema Yisrael of the Jew. You know, that's what we label it. And as we said, we want to understand, what is it about Shema Yisrael? Like he says, everybody together, affiliated, knowledgeable, religious, not religious, whatever it was. And you're talking in Warsaw, you had every kind of Jew all screamed out together, Shema Yisrael, at that point. What is it? Why, of all the psukim, of all the things, is it the Shema Yisrael? So we have to understand what this is. So we'll, layer by layer, let's uncover. First, let's look at it. Let's look in the Chumash and understand what it means. It's something we do every day. It's one of the mitzvahs, actually, that according to most opinions, it is a mitzvah. The Shema doesn't actually have a mitzvah. The Shema is more the introduction. The mitzvah is the Ahavta, to love Hashem. That's what's incorporated, and that's why, and Shema is more the concept of Kabbalah Sol, accepting the yoke of heaven. So to actually internalize that we have one God, as we've mentioned already before, and to make sure that that's our constant perspective on every single moment of our life. But let's see how we say it, how we read it in the Psukim, and as we know, we say it either once a day, twice a day, three times a day, depending on who you are and how you daven. But at least once a day, most people say Shema Yisrael. And hopefully when they wake up in the morning, when we go to sleep at night. And it's just something beyond, right? So let's understand. So looking into your pages first, let's see what the Shema Yisrael is. Okay, so we say like this. So I'll share it right here and see it in here. Okay. So the Shema Yisrael, Sorry, I don't know why there's so much extra stuff over here, so I can't see anything. I don't know how to make this bigger. Let me see. Ah, okay, beautiful. Okay. So, as you can see on your pages, it's actually the last line on this page. This is chapter 6, Perek Vav, in Parshas Ve'eschanan Chumash Devarim. And it says like this in Pasuk Dalit, it says, as we see, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elikeinu, and then on the next page, Hashem Echad, right? So, famous, beautiful words. Let's see how, first the translation, Hear, O Israel, Hashem our God, Hashem is one. It is a little bit repetitive, the Pasuk, if you notice. I know we don't think about it because we just say it's like so what we say. But he very easily could have said, Hear, O Israel, Hashem Elikeinu, right? Hashem our God is one. Right? It could have said Hashem Elikeinu Echad. Instead it says Hashem Elikeinu Hashem Echad. You see, it's interesting. So it has a bit of an extra word there, seemingly. We'll have to understand why. But even to understand this pasuk, if you look, you can see something interesting, that the ayin is big. Do you see that? Mm. And then if you look on the next page, the dalit is also big, right? What word does that make? Aid. Aid is witness, testimony. This is the biggest testimony of the Jew. This is our testimony that there's one God. This is what we live with. Also, we have to live Shema Yisrael. Like in other words, when a person sees us as a Jew, we represent God. That's actually a lot of, some people explain that's really the mitzvah. We'll see that. The mitzvah is the Kiddush Hashem that we make by living properly as a Jew and therefore spreading godliness, becoming the testimony to God in the world. Okay, let's see. Let's just see how Rashi explains. So first Rashi says, Hashem, our God, Hashem is one. So look on the bottom. So he says, Hashem, Shehu Elekeinu, Hashem, who is our God now, Ata now, V'loy Elekei Ha'umais, but not the God of the other nations. This is interesting. Hashu Asid Liyais Hashem Echad, He is destined to be the one God. Shenemar, as it says, he's quoting from the prophets, the beautiful prophecy, Ki az epaych el amim sofa brura, for then they shall change, then I shall change the nations to speak a clear language, likrei kulam b'shem Hashem, so that they may all call out in the name of Hashem. And as we know, it says, "Bayayimahu yi Hashem echad u'shmai echad." On that day, Hashem will be one, and His name will be one. Rashi is saying something very fascinating here. According to Rashi, this is actually when we're saying Shema, it's our hope. It's our looking forward to the future. It's actually noticing that now it's not that way. I mean, we don't need, unfortunately, any reminders. You just put on the news for 1 second and you can see how everybody is denying the one God. That's what they're doing. They're denying the truth. They're denying what is good and what is bad, right? They're just totally convoluted. So there isn't one God at the moment. But what we are saying when we say Shema Yisrael is we are looking forward. We know that the time is coming very, very close where everybody will recognize the one God, the one truth, the way it is, what is good. And that's going to happen very soon. So part of saying Shema is actually the hope, but the hope how do you say it? The hope with confidence that it's going to happen. That Hashem is going to transform the way everybody sees the perspective. Everybody's perspective is the way everybody sees the world. And that's part of what Shema is. But at the same time, what it's acknowledging is that they don't see it now. So it's actually fascinating. Which means, as I said, we don't need reminders. However, sometimes we do because we can get a bit confused. Up until now, we were confused. You know, you might think, the world, it's okay. You know, it's all right. You don't have to be so strong about, you know, what's, you know. It's okay. We can have how do you say it? Everybody can have their own way of looking at things. And everybody could, you know, we can be a little bit gray in our convictions, so to speak, weak. You can see from here, no, we have to remember that at the moment, the way the perspective of the world, it's off. And what it leads to is disaster. Just give it a moment, and that's what happens. So that's the Shema already. That's just Rashi. I want to read the Pesukim, and we're going to see more in depth after. Then we go to the next Pasuk, V'yahavta, right? That's the Pasuk, that's the paragraph we say. Notice Baruch Shem that we all say is not in the Chumash. Many people don't realize that those are not words from the Chumash. Baruch Shem Kvod Malchusay. We'll see where they come from. That's what we say to make a bit of an interruption between the Pasuk of Shema Yisrael and the paragraph of Yahafta. We do need to make a bit of an interruption. According to some opinions, that's why, you know, the word Echad, the best way to say Echad is to make it a little bit longer, like Echad, I don't know if you ever, to stretch it out a bit. And the idea being, first of all, to understand that that word means more than just one. It represents, the Aleph represents the one God. The Ches is eight, is the seven heavens and the earth. And the Dalit are the four corners of the world. That the one God is everywhere. Obviously, that's just, you know, but what that means is every part of our life is not only controlled and run and energized, but we have to make sure to insert him into every aspect and every part of our life. And that's what Echad is. And the Dalit being big, there's a cute thing that one of the Rabbeim said, he said, it's like an axe. That what we have, if you think of it, that we have to actually, I don't know if I have the right word, we have to sort of, it's more like you would say a hammer. Like you have to knock it into you constantly, the oneness of God. Because although we say it, what does it really mean? And, you know, I'll tell you something interesting. You know, when we shouldn't, even on small things, in a small way, in life. And it's good in a way sometimes when we can just coast along, because that means that things are not going wrong, right? But the truth is we don't want to live life coasting along. So when we just coast along, a lot of times we have worries, we have normal anxieties, the normal stuff. You know, how we're going to manage for Pesach, the good normal stuff, right? It's normal. But the truth is, somebody who has real betachen, who has real trust, won't be filled with anxiety, right? Because they know who runs the world. God runs the world. It's all going to work out somehow. However Hashem wants it to, it's how it's going to work out. He will give us the energy. He will make it possible if it's meant to be. So if the echad is really like knocked into our head, we will live a life where Hashem is taka one. That's what it shows. A life where Hashem is one in our life. How do we know? How can we, so to speak, gauge that? If we live with that calmness, with that inner bitachon. So that's just on a small scale already. We can see that this is something that we really have to consciously live with. And the proof that it's not easy, we have to say it twice a day. If it was easy, we could say it once a year and just remember it. You know, let's just remember of Yom Kippur, we'll say Shema Yisrael, and it'll become our life the whole year. So we shouldn't feel bad when during the day we do have certain anxious feelings, because Hashem knows that. That's how we are. That's normal. That's why we say Shema again, to remind ourselves, to reset every single time. Reset, reset. There's only one God. It's going to be okay. He runs our life. So we need this constant reminder. But we also need to know that the Shema Yisrael is, as we can see, it's a declaration, right? It's a Hashem is one. But then we come to the mitzvah, to the commandment. What's that? So in other words, Shema Yisrael is our declaration, you know, that we have one God, you know, and he's one, and we're going to live our life that way. But then what's the actual real mitzvah is v'yahavta. And let's see what we go on with this paragraph. Here Hashem commands us, and he tells us, v'yahavta es Hashem aleikecha b'chol levavcha u'v'chol nafshecha u'v'chol mo'edecha. Now we know this pasuk has so much, but just on a simple level, let's see how Rashi puts it. V'yahavta, you shall love. And what does he say you shall love? How do we love Hashem? There's many different explanations. And this, I'll tell you what, we're going to do more next week. And we mentioned this question when we talked about the jealousy. How can we be commanded on an emotion? This is a very big question, because this is a command. It's one of the mitzvahs. Love Hashem. How can we, either we love or we don't love, right? That's one question. But even sometimes we're not so worried philosophically. Let's just say we are commanded. How do we do it? What is the translation? How do we measure? If it's a mitzvah, it needs to be measured. Like, you know, when we eat matzah on Pesach, you have to eat a certain amount of matzah, and the matzah has to be baked a certain way to make it kosher for Pesach. So we know we can do the mitzvah. How do we measure this mitzvah? How do we know that we love Hashem? And how do we even come to loving Hashem? So let's see Rashi's answer. There's many different ways. Rashi tells us like this. You shall love. So he gives us very easy, actually. It's a very easy formula. He says, Asa dvarav, perform his words. Do his commandments. May ahava, out of love. And then, so in other words, according to Rashi, what is the measure of love? Doing the mitzvahs. Doing them with love. In other words, enthusiastically, wantingly, not begrudgingly, not saying, oh, I have to whatever this today. Oh, I mean, the easier ones are like, you know, when we come to sit down to, I don't know, to either to learn something inspiring or perhaps even at the Seder itself when we're all sitting finally. What's harder is, oh, I have to clean for Pesach, you know, whatever. But the point is, we do it with love, right? That's so doing the mitzvahs with love is loving Hashem. That's how Rashi says it. And then he goes on and he says, why? What's so important about love? So he says, one who serves out of love cannot be compared to one who serves out of fear. The reason why Rashi mentions this is because what's the difference? It's like, if Hashem tells us to do a mitzvah, why does it matter how we do the mitzvah? Just as long as we're doing it, we're fulfilling the commandment. It's like, you know, if you ask somebody to do you a favor, right? And let's say it's just, an example. You ask them to pick up your challah that, you know, you can't get to this bakery this Friday. Will they please pick up your challah? Now, does it matter if they go pick up the challah in a clean car or not a clean, I mean, maybe it does, but does it matter if they have a fancy car? Does it matter if they do it with a smile? Does it, who cares if they are dressed up when they go get the challah? Who cares? As long as the challah, especially if you're not home, they're going to drop it by your door. As long as you're going to have the challah, what do you care how they did it, right? You got the challah. Why does it matter how we do the mitzvah? It's a commandment, right? It's something Hashem wants us to fulfill. So Rashi here says something very beautiful. He says, you can't compare somebody who serves Hashem out of love or serves somebody out of love to out of fear. Why? What's the difference? As we know, one who serves his masters out of fear, kishuhu matriach alav, once the master overburdens him, manicha, he leaves his master, v'haylech lai, and he goes off on his own. This is an interesting way of explaining it, which means that as soon as anything becomes challenging, if you're doing it just out of fear, well, you'll give it up. It's too much. It's a burden. But if you're doing it out of love, and we all know this, I mean, the best example is a mother who wakes up when their baby's 6 weeks old and the whole night they're up with their baby. Okay, they might be very tired, but they're not giving the baby away. No matter what, they're not giving the baby away. They're keeping this baby. They love this baby because of love. But if it's somebody else's child, maybe you'll say, maybe you can come pick them up, right? You'll give it away. So that's the difference. This is how we see. We'll hold on to it. We'll cherish it no matter what. So this is the way Rashi explains it. It's a simple way, but it's practically quite a deep thing. The reason also, the flow, I'm sorry, we didn't read the pasuk before. It actually talks about fearing God. In the pasuk just before, it says, "Leman tira es Hashem alekecha," you should fear Hashem, your God, and you should do his mitzvahs in that way. And the truth is that there is a concept of fearing God. We have both fear and love, and there's actually even a higher level of fear, which is higher than love, but we're going to leave that aside. But on a simple level, serving God out of fear means that we serve God because he said so. It's like a disciplined kind of way. You do the mitzvah because that's what God said. But love means you appreciate it. You have this pleasure in doing it. You want to. So there is a question that comes out from this. If this is the case, perhaps, why is it that the mitzvah of fearing Hashem is an eternal mitzvah? In other words, shouldn't it just be a stepping stone? Like say, okay, so first you'll do it because you have to, but hopefully you'll grow, right? And you'll start to appreciate, and then you'll do it out of love. And then the mitzvah of the fear should be left out. It shouldn't be there anymore. But that's not the case. Fear and love are always an obligation. What does doing a mitzvah out of fear add to doing a mitzvah out of love? It's interesting. There's something.
Is it fear or awe?
Okay, so that's a better word. Awe for sure is more the word. And the truth is, with fear and awe, there's like different levels in the fear. It says, some people say that the simplest level would mean to do it because you're afraid of punishment. But that's a very basic level. A much.
What the word fear.
I know, but that's what it does. That's what you think of when you think of fear. You think, okay, like the policeman's going to give you the ticket so you don't speed. But then there's the concept that you know that you appreciate the value and you don't want to transgress. Like, for example, you are aware, and this is a little bit of a deeper level, you're aware that every time you do a mitzvah, you connect to God. Every time you don't, you disconnect, and you don't want for a moment to be disconnected. So you're in that level of, in a sense, there is a fear of the disconnect. A fear of doing something that will cause you to not be in God's presence. That's what you don't want. right? So the truth is they both have a value, and you can see from this level of fear what that really means. Because the idea also is sometimes, and this is interesting, with love, love is more about yourself. That's the truth. It's more you feeling. It's how you feel, right? It's what it does for you, the benefits that you gain from it, right? That's love. Love is that good, uplifted, warm, fuzzy feeling that you get from doing a mitzvah. But when you do it out of awe, as we say, it's more about God-focused. Although it's true you don't want to be disconnected, but it's because you also want to fulfill the mission that God entrusted you to do. And that's in a certain way more altruistic. It's a higher level in a certain way, and that's extremely important to maintain. But there is an interesting thing, because even though Rashi here says that if you serve out of fear, you'll be more quickly to shrug it off when it's difficult, the truth is that certain types of awe perhaps also keep you doing something. What do I mean? Because when you do something from love, what you might tend to do, and this is not a terrible thing, but you might tend to mix in your perspective. So like, let's say if you love somebody and you wanted, you're preparing, I don't know, something, a very beautiful meal. So the truth is you'll obviously try to make the foods they like, but you'll make it the way you make it. You know, what you, how you think it's going to be good, right? In other words, you'll make the cake that you can make the best. Or you'll put the ingredient that, or you'll set the table the way you think it looks nice. When it comes to awe, it's more about the other person. It's more that I better get it right so they're not upset, right? So you'll be more concerned with what they want. And that's part of also how we have to make sure to keep the letter of the law properly, not only the enthusiasm. And that's what each one complements. So that's why we have both. Okay, let's move on. Then we have the famous words, b'chol levavcha, b'chol nafshecha, u'v'chol ma'idecha. So we know, what does it say, b'chol levavcha, with all your heart? B'shnei yitzarecha, because the famous question is, why does it say b'chol levavcha? It should say b'chol libcha. You see, there's an extra base. Levavcha sounds like two hearts. Do we have two hearts? So we say we do. We have two sides of the heart, right? That's every person. Wants two things. We're drawn to the physical, to the material, to ourselves, and we're drawn to the godliness, to the something higher, somebody, to doing something for somebody else, right? To the godly soul, to the animal soul, however you want to translate it. Yetzahari, Yetzahariv. We're all made up of both components. We're, whatever, a bit schizophrenic. Okay, so he says, but we have to serve God with both of your drives. The drive towards good and the drive towards evil. Which means, when he talks about the drive towards evil, he means serving Hashem with that does all those like things that we're drawn to, like the physical, the material, but you can also serve Hashem with that. And we know the simple way we say, when we have a desire for physical things, obviously we shouldn't allow ourselves to sink into that. Obviously that shouldn't become our total focus. However, as human beings, it's normal. It's natural. Therefore, what do? So the typical example that's used, we like a nice dishes, we like to have a nice house, we like to have the table set nicely. Do it for Shabbos, do it for a yontif, or do it with guests in your house. So therefore, you elevate that physical, material desire, and it becomes directed to serving Hashem. Or even on a simple level, and a typical evening, let's just say if somebody is motivated and they set the table nicely that day, they decide that they want to use the nice dish that day. But when you're doing it, you're thinking, for example, you speak a little bit nicer, or you act, it gives you that lift of that mood. So already you're directing it in a higher way. So therefore you can serve Hashem, as we say, from both. From one is like the outright davening, the outright learning, the spiritual things. That's clearly godliness. But even from the material side, we know as Jews, we definitely serve Hashem that way as well. Okay, then he says, Davar Acher, another explanation. B'chol levavcha, with all your heart, he says, Shelo yiyeh libcha chaluk. This is a very hard one, but we know he says that your heart should not be divided. Al hamakim, about the omnipresent. What does he mean, divided? And this is, as we said, not simple. And it comes in the next one also, but I'll show you. Look what he says on the bottom in number 4. That is, you should not question the justice of any misfortune Hashem may inflict on the world, even if its purpose is not evident. Nor should you question the justice of any reward enjoyed by the wicked. We know this is one of the most difficult things. We're going through it now. It's very difficult. We work towards it. I always say, strive. That's why we say it all day. because we do question, because that's normal. And the truth is, it's not even so bad sometimes to question another person's suffering. In other words, if it motivates us to daven to Hashem that He should help them, right? Or to daven, or to motivate us to do something for them. That's a good thing. What really we shouldn't, and we'll see it comes more to the next one, we shouldn't really question when it's us. And of course, it's normal too. We're not saying it's normal, but we work on it. That's why we say this every day. If we can even make a little bit of peace with what's happening to us, with our situation, and even partially accept, that's driving towards it. That's what we're doing. We're accepting with all our heart whatever Hashem gives us. That's a hard avoda, and we'll see, we'll discuss it a little bit more after, because we'll see how the Gemara says it. Let's see what the next one is. That's b'chol levavcha, u'b'chol nafshecha, with all your soul. And as we know, this is not easy. Afilu hu noitel es nafshecha, even if he takes your soul. Look, we always thought this was from times of old. Unfortunately, it's from times of now. He says, this too is implied by all. It means that a person should be willing to give his life for the sanctification of the name of Hashem when the situation calls for it. And he says that it also means that a person must feel the love of Hashem even if his life is being taken for his sake. Hopefully we shouldn't have to do this practically. Unfortunately, in Israel, it's many times over, and even here, we've seen it, we've experienced it in our own lives, people giving up their life, al kiddush Hashem, uv'chol nafshecha. We know one very beautiful thing that we are told is that when we say this, and we say this every single day, if we're aware, I mean, at least sometimes, I mean, it's sometimes we're just saying it and we're thinking of everything we have to do that day, but if we can at least once in a while concentrate and realize that when we say this and we are willing, Hashem considers it as if. That's what it says. Hopefully we should not be put into that position. But every single moment, every day when we say this and we are willing, so to speak, to give up our life, what that means for us, what that translates practically is that the times when things are not so easy for us to do, like, and we're talking even simply, a day that we don't feel so well, a day that things are not going the way it should, whether it be even emotionally or mentally in our families and whatever it is, and things are not easy. But if we are willing to live our life the way Hashem dictates and respond properly, control ourselves, whatever it takes, do the mitzvah, whether it's hard, do, you know, the mitzvah in a way that we might not want, whatever it may be. If we are willing to do that, we are really giving up our soul for Hashem. That's what we're doing. In other words, what we are saying is that we are in your hands, God. We realize it. You control us, and therefore you're dictating our life. So whatever you're dictating, we are willing to live with that, or even to die for that. And dying doesn't mean necessarily life and death, as we're saying. Dying means giving up a part of ourself. That's a certain type of death, when we are willing to be very uncomfortable in a certain situation. And this, and accepting that, because it's Hashem's will. That's part of uv'chol nafshecha. Again, these are not easy things, but that's why we have to constantly be saying it. But it's a very, very, very big mitzvah, and one of the fundamentals. Now, what's v'chol ma'idecha? So the easy one, it seems, we think it's easy, it says with all your possessions, right? He says v'chol ma'mancha, with all your money. We know that a Jew is meant to spend as much as needed, and in Sydney, I think we think about how much meat costs, and how much and Pesach is coming, and even Shabbos, it's expensive. But we say, okay, we'll serve God with all our money, it's okay, we'll put up with that. Expensive, not expensive, we're willing to spend for a mitzvah. He says, interesting, the question that is always asked is, usually when you're told to do something, first you're told to do the easy thing, and then a little bit harder, and then a little bit harder. You know, even if you ask somebody for a favor, usually you ask them the easy, you go, that's how you do it. A bit more, a bit more, a bit more. This seems interesting. After what we've just said about serving God with both your hearts, being willing to give up your life for Him, so you know, what's money? What's the big deal? Of course I'll spend the money. If I'm giving up my life, my soul, my desires, everything, why shouldn't I give up my money? So that's why Rashi says, and this is such an interesting thing, Yesh lecha adam, he says, there can be a person, shemamaynei chaviv alav migufay, whose money is more precious to him than his body. And that's why it says, b'chol ma'idecha. Now we think, oh, but unfortunately it's been proven. So many people live, first of all, they give their last bit of energy just to make another dollar. You see that. That means, if you think about it, their money is worth more than their health. Their money is worth more than their life. That's the first sign. Anybody who's willing to do that, that's the first sign. But not only that, you see, it's so crazy, but you see people, I mean, as we say, the almighty dollar, you know, and it's like people will go through such length and do things that are illegal, do things that are not only illegal, but immoral for money. How could that be? It's obvious. They don't think, but if they would think, they would realize that the value they're putting on their money is more than the value that they're putting on their life, because a person doesn't want to live with that. They have a conscience, right? No, that's how it is. Anyways, that's why it says. But then there's another way to translate B'chol Ma'idecha. He says, B'chol Ma'idecha, and this is similar to what we said before, but it's even a little bit step further, B'chol Mida U'mida Shemaydeh Lecha. With each and every measure that he measures out to you. As he says, Rashi spells it out. Bein b'midah taiva. Be it with the measure of goodness. Bein b'midas puranos. Whether it be a measure of punishment. And he brings Psukim HaDavid HaMelech says, Kais Yeshuais Es. I want to show you on the bottom. Because David HaMelech says, I shall raise up a cup of salvation. And after he says, I find distress and anguish. Look at number 10 on the bottom. He says, in Tehillim, if you look, it says, Kais Yeshua says, so right, I lift up a cup of salvation. U'b'shem Hashem Ekra. I will call out in the name of Hashem. But he says, U'b'shem Hashem Ekra also, Tzara V'yagain, right? Whether it's painful for me, I call out in the name of Hashem. Or whether I'm picking up the cup of salvation, meaning things are good, I call out in the name of Hashem. David HaMelech says, both ways, and he says it in the same language, I call out the name of Hashem, whether things are openly good or things are not openly good. Things actually seem very painful and are very challenging. Again, this is a hard one, but this is something we're meant to live with every single moment. This is the part that we talk about, the acceptance. The living life with the total acceptance. Hashem is in control, and whatever he does is for the good, as we say, like Rabbi Akiva used to say, right? Or Nochamish Gamzu, how he said, Gamzu L'Toiva. And Rabbi Akiva would say, Kol Mad Avid Rachmana L'Tav Avid. Everything that Hashem does is for the good, right? That's what Hashem, that's how we're meant to live. And that's what we say every day in Shema. This is the mitzvah that we are meant to live with. Again, not easy. Nobody's saying it's not easy, but, and also, I feel very much that people sometimes make the mistake and think this is like black and white. It is black and white in a certain, but it's something we should, when we're assessing, when we're reflecting, we have to measure ourselves based on improvement. If today we were a little bit less resentful, that's a tremendous step. So it's all a matter of putting it into context of our own lives, of our own personality, and working towards growing. It's just a matter of growing. More and more acceptance, more and more making peace with, but in a good way, in a happy way, somehow or other. You know, it's a hard one, yeah. So this is a big one, as we say. This is even just the first pasuk of the, as we say, of Yahafta. Okay, I want, and this is only Rashi, but I want to just see, if we go to the next page. Let's just read through the other pasukim quickly. Oh yeah, I feel bad. We didn't. Okay, v'hayu, let's just see. Okay, v'hayu hadvarim ha'ela, and these words that I command you, asher anochim b'tzavcha yayin, that I command you today, al levavecha shall be upon your heart. What does he mean, these words? So Rashi says, umahu ha'ava, as we mentioned before, how do you define this love? So he says, v'hayu hadvarim ha'ela, and these words shall be upon your heart. What does that mean? Shemitoich kach, for as a result of this, which means reflecting upon the words of Torah, that's the love. The love is learning Torah, doing mitzvahs. That's the love. He says what happens is, ata makir b'hakadosh baruch hu, you become aware of the Holy One, blessed be He, umedabek bedrachav, and attach yourself to His ways. Which means, according to Rashi, and I'll tell you why, we're going to see next week more why I say according to Rashi, because there's different ways of coming to loving Hashem and to doing these words. Rashi's formula is through Torah. Learn Torah. What happens when you learn Torah? Then, afterwards, when you go into the world, the whole perspective, you have different kind of glasses. What you see in the world becomes a whole different thing, a whole different experience. You're looking through the lens of Torah, right? I'll tell you why I say that. What do I mean? Because there are other commentaries, as we'll develop it more next week, that say there's another way to come to loving Hashem. How would you say, what would be the best way for you to come to love God, so to speak? How do you love somebody? How do you come to loving somebody? I mean, besides like the automatic chemistry we talk about, but what else makes you love somebody?
Looking for the good.
Looking for the good. Okay, so in life, let's just say, if you know people, how does love grow when you... I'm talking even just, you know, regular people, not necessarily family.
Direction.
What?
Reactions.
Reactions, okay. And as you...
The challenges,
that's interesting. Challenges. When you're going through, you're saying together certain challenges. Yes.
I'm just thinking...
Yeah, no, 100%. 100%. Yeah, yeah, it's true.
Come on, that's true. A challenge. It comes a child, then it comes no job, and then there is a job, and then there isn't.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, 100%. That's all. No, 100%.
All things that test the love.
Oh, my God, they test it. And then hopefully you get strong. Hopefully it's stronger.
It's not the same.
Yeah.
It's
true. 100%. There is also, I mean, even just like a sort of on a more basic level, the more you know somebody, and hopefully, unless there's something negative, the more you know somebody and the more good, as you're saying, that they've done, whether it be for you or for others, the more you appreciate them in that way. Like you see them and you say, wow, the more it can build a certain sense of respect, but also love, right? So if you notice, let's say if you have a friend, and over the years you see how much they go out of the way for others, or how much good they do, or how beautiful their reactions, or how, you know, deep they are, or how intelligent, or whatever it may be, the more you appreciate and you love them. So there is a train of thought that says that one of the ways to come to loving God, and I'm not saying this is not true, I'm just saying this is not Rashi's way, that the best way is take a walk every day on the beach, or just go to botanical gardens and look at the magnificence of nature, and you'll appreciate, or even some people who are lucky enough or perhaps who have the insight and are able to see in biology, whether they're a doctor or they're a scientist, and you know, you study the wonders of how Hashem created the world. And the more you do that, the more you'll love God, because you'll say, what a God this is that is created. I think we see that a lot of times when we look, I don't know, I was there with a baby and you see the wonders of how they grow and how they develop. That's where you can I think that's where you see it the quickest in a way almost. When you see a baby from when they're born to when they're a year old and all the different things they can do. And then even when you just study them when they're sleeping and you look at it's just magnificent and beyond amazing to watch. And you just can't help but be filled with wow, the Creator created such a magical thing. If somebody studies the brain, as we say, as we learn, and also even interestingly, when we see the deficiencies, when somebody gets sick, sometimes we even appreciate more how it is that the person's body works when it works. It's unbelievable, right? That even for us, on a day that we don't feel so well or things are not working so right, and hopefully we can stop and pause and say, wow, it's amazing how it does when it does work. So that is one way of coming to love Hashem. However, you can see Rashi says something else. He's not contradicting that, but he's saying the real formula is first learn Torah, then do mitzvahs, then go out and look at nature. The reason he says that is because we know, and this is a fact, you can go into nature and still deny God. We know people who do that. We can see they were the greatest civilizations, the German people, who studied the greatest sciences and the greatest philosophy. And boy, oh boy, I don't think that they had God, right? That definitely is not the kind of God that we would call God, right? So, and even now you can see many people will say whatever they'll say. It's not God. I don't know. Somehow they find a way of saying that.
Evolution,
exactly. So how do you go into nature and appreciate that nature is God is by first learning Torah. So you have to have the right perspective, put on the right glasses first, and then go out into nature. Perhaps we can say even practically, like again, everybody has to do what works for them. But sometimes what would be nice is after you have a shiur and after you hear something inspiring, then to take a walk and to look at the nature, right? And then, so that's really the best formula, because then what will happen is that it's not even only the taking the walk, it's everything in life that we experience, but start to really notice all the magnificence and the magic of how the world works. And that's really the formula. So that's how Rashi says these words. That's why Dvarim Ha'ela, these words, all the words of Torah that we have learned, that's what you have to put on your heart. And that's what will enable you to notice and become aware. And once you're aware, then comes the next step. You want to attach yourself to his ways. And according, see, Rashi's putting it all into here. So according to Rashi, attaching yourself to Hashem is part of the mitzvah of loving Hashem. There are commentaries that say, no, that's two separate mitzvahs. There's love of Hashem and there's cleaving, because cleaving is so much deeper. Cleaving, they compare, it's like, you know, if somebody's like lovesick, you know, it's like you can't separate. It's when something, it's when you become obsessed with something. That's what cleaving is. Literally obsessed. I mean, the great Kabbalists in the songs, you know, even in, sometimes we don't translate, like even in Shir HaShirim, or some of the beautiful songs that we sing, the Ka'echsef. Ka'echsef has now become a very famous song that some people sing on Shabbos. And if you, the word echsef is to, like, I don't even know how you translate it. It's like you yearn so much. It's like you, it's such a strong desire. That's what it is. He desires to be one with God. Rev Aaron of Karlin wrote that he had that feeling, just like we have for, as we say, when you hold and cuddle a baby, that love, that's how much they loved God. You know, they had such, it was like so real godliness to them. And that's really cleaving to Hashem, to the point, as they say, they couldn't even think of anything else, only of the love of God. As there's a famous story of the Alter Rebbe, of the first Chabad Rebbe, how he said once, I don't need your Gan Eden, I don't need your world to come, I only need you alone. In other words, it wasn't the reward of the mitzvah, it was just godliness himself that he wanted to be connected to. Obviously, these things for us are a little bit removed. But when we learn them, when we hear them, we understand, and we do. I must say, we all have a taste. Because when we do a mitzvah, many times, it could even be a simple mitzvah. Sometimes the simple mitzvahs do it more for us. Sometimes even being with, for example, when you're visiting somebody or whatever it may be, you have the merit, really, to be able to do something for somebody else, to actually help them, you can sometimes be filled with such an incredible feeling of, like, appreciation for life. And it's an appreciation that God has given you the ability to do that. And not only the ability, but the opportunity to do that. And that's that feeling of really cleaving, if you want to say, that nothing else exists at that moment. Even everything you're missing disappears. You realize all the negativity disappears, and that moment you feel complete. And that's what we're talking about. So it's actually a magnificent thing, and it's such a beautiful gift that Hashem gives us. And as Rashi gives us a simple formula, more mitzvahs that we do, the more we'll be able to have that opportunity. So again, talking about... Oh, okay. I'll just read the end of the pasuk. He says, "Asher anochi mitzavcha hayom, that I command you today, lo yeh." And this is a very famous thing that actually comes many times in the Chumash. He says, "Lo yeh beinecha," they should not be in your eyes. And a very interesting language, kidiyatakma yeshana, like an old edict, like an old command. Shein adam seifna, that which a person does not attach any importance. Rather, it should be like a new one. Shahakol ruts in the krasa, towards which everybody runs. And he says this word, this edict word, is an order of the king which comes in writing. And like in the Megillah we had it also, right? That Achashverosh sent out all these edicts, right? What are we talking about? This is such an important one. Again, we say this every day. So that's why every single day when we wake up, we should be filled with the most tremendous feeling of gratitude that we have an opportunity today to do this mitzvah. And it's as if it was given to us today. And it's not just as if, because when we say it, it was. It means that when Hashem restores our neshama to us every morning and gives us another day, at the same time, he's also giving us the Torah again. Every day it's new. It's a new mitzvah, a new opportunity to daven, a new opportunity even just to say Shema and V'yahafta, and a new opportunity to see something in it, to understand something, to appreciate something which we didn't yesterday. But even if not, even if the mitzvah is the same, right? Even if we do it the same, it's still the fact that we can do it again. That is such a privilege. And this is how we have to view, and again, as we've mentioned many times, when we live life like that, that hayom, it's a new day, and it's a new opportunity, and it's such a gift that we have it, Well, then there's no question that even with all the things that worry us, and I'm not downplaying, they're real. And even the fears, even the anxieties, even the everything, even the burdens that we bear, and the challenges that we face, they're still there. And at the same time, we have an energy from that gratitude and a joy from the fact that we have the opportunity to serve Hashem today, even if nothing else, even just for that, just the fact that we can say Shema, even if that's all we can do. That itself can give us that feeling. And that's what we're saying. So every day we have to appreciate from anew. It's as if it's a new Torah today. That's it. So even just in this pasuk already, there's so much. I don't know if we would think about it. It would take a long time to daven. But the point is that's what we say. You know, they say about the word great chassidim. Even in the Gemara it mentions that davened all day. But in our times we have this, I remember growing up, we had this very interesting song that chassidim sing. It's in Yiddish, essen estzich, schlafen schlaftzich, like eating it easy, you know, it's easy. It's sleeping, it comes easy. Vazal mintan azis daven sachnish. What should we do? Davening doesn't come that way, right? And what do we mean? They all daven. My father shared with me that when he was young, he went to a yeshiva away from home. He was 11 years old. He already went to this dormitory and they were singing this niggun and he couldn't understand. These were old chassidim with white beards. He's 11 years old. They don't daven? He saw them daven. What does they mean that it doesn't daven? Until he understood what they meant. They meant that their davening doesn't have this spiritual, yes, this depth. And that's what davening is really meant to be. It's an avaida, as we say, because when we daven, imagine if we would at least even concentrate on one of these things, how different our entire day would be. And this is the idea, as we say, what we hope for. And that in itself we ask Hashem. We ask Hashem to help us with that as well. And in Mirtz Hashem, at least a little bit, we try. So Hashem should give us that we should live, as we say, inspired lives. In Mirtz Hashem. But yeah, we should have, as we say, the Shema Yisro. We should be able to scream it out for good things, not in times of distress, in times of goodness, where we are causing a Kiddush Hashem in a good way, that we say that the whole world should be able to see and all declare that truth is there is only one God. And that's what we're in Mirtz Hashem. It will happen soon, as he says.